Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Welcome, friends and lovers. We're here to talk about something that is not fiction writing from the late 19th century or early 20th century, but about cinema. Specifically, a 2014 film called Interstellar.
This is our extra credit for Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're talking sci-fi and time dilation this month, obviously, and Finney's pal, Issa, suggested that he watch the Christopher Nolan movie, Interstellar. And I said, oh, you know, actually, I always meant to watch that movie. I never got around to it. So Finney and I watched it on Sunday together, and I thought it was spectacular. And I suggested to you to watch because you never saw it either.
It's insane how much I didn't see it. Because around the time this came out 2014?
Yes.
A little before that, I had finished my script for The Time Capsule. And I was going around town pitching a time dilation script. There was like no meeting I had where this didn't come up, this movie. Also, I love Christopher Nolan's stuff. Almost every movie of his that I've seen.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I realized when I was going to rent it last night that SAG, the SAG nominating awards committee I was on for a while, they sent me a screener. So I actually had it. It was sent to my house. And I still didn't watch it. And I really don't know why. But as you know, there's a long speech in the movie about how love may be more than emotion, maybe a type of intuition.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe I was experiencing that because I watched the movie last night. And even though I liked every bit of it, I didn't really connect to it. So I don't have anything I hate about it. I can't crap on it or anything. I love thinking about the concepts, beautiful movie. But I just didn't really enjoy it that much. And I think I might have had a little bit of intuition about that from the materials. And maybe that's why I put it off.
I didn't know anything about this movie. I knew Matthew McConaughey was in there.
Yeah.
I thought Anne Hathaway was in there maybe. I don't know. Because there's that clip where it's like him crying watching a thing. And I've seen people edit other things into that.
I've seen that.
It's funny. But I knew it had something to do with time dilation. That was it. I knew nothing else about this movie.
I didn't know Anne Hathaway was in it till you mentioned that. I didn't know that at all. And I thought it was Bryce Dallas Howard who was in there and not Jessica Chastain.
Well, that happens a lot.
So
I think
that's
Conan O'Brien brought that up to Jessica Chastain, saying that people get confused with the two.
They're in the same category. They're both really good.
They're good. They honestly, just because they're redheads, they don't actually look a lot. Like if you look at pictures of them together, Jessica Chastain is a lot more angular featured.
Yeah.
And Bryce Dallas Howard has a more rounded feature. They look very different.
Yes. And I appreciate both of them as performers. I just that I guess it's to illustrate that I didn't really I don't know.
Exactly.
Somehow this passed me by.
You don't know. But as I said, time dilation is a big part of that. And in case you don't know what time dilation is the changing of the movement of time due to either speed or gravitational influences. So the faster you go, the slower time moves for you. And this is special relativity. The closer you go to the speed of light, the slower time passes for you, to the point of theoretically freezing if you actually do go the speed of light. So for example, photons don't, I mean, they're not living things, but they don't experience any time themselves. Everything, like if a photon was starting and then stopped after going 100 million years, to it, it would seem like nothing happened. It just popped into another place.
If you put little googly eyes on it.
Yes.
You would understand. Yeah, it would have emotions at that point.
Exactly. And also it requires infinite energy to go the speed of light, which, you know, there's another problem with it. It doesn't really work.
But I know what you're saying. And that's an observable thing. It's not just a crazy theory. You know, on Earth, we can measure in that if we sync our watches and then one of us travels at extraordinary speeds, that time will have slowed down for that person.
Yes, they have they've done this with jet fighters.
Right.
Flying really, really fast, you know, going Mach 4 for a long time, and they get out and they look at their watches and there's a discrepancy. So
I go Mach 4 every day, though.
I don't think Mach 4 is attainable on Earth, but maybe, I don't know.
I just do it with my style.
Yeah, you sure do. Now, on the flip side of that, strong gravity slows time down. So if you're closer to a big planet or a star, the more time is slower for you than compared to Earth. And this is general relativity. And this is something that satellites need to factor into their time stuff. So when you get satellite time, because they're further away from Earth and Earth's gravity, time moves differently for them. So there's a discrepancy. And they know the equations, and it's all factored into it. So they're able to give us accurate time. It's amazing stuff. But we're talking about a movie. It's called Interstellar, directed by Christopher Nolan, written by Christopher and Jonathan Nolan. It stars Matthew McConaughey, Anne Hathaway, Michael Caine, and, as you said, Jessica Chastain.
Yeah.
And also a surprise appearance by Matt Damon, which I had no idea that was coming.
Neither did the filmmakers. He crashed the set. They didn't want him in there. There were so many movie stars in the thing, it kind of threw me off. His son is Timothy Chalamet.
Yeah, he's like a little kid, though.
Yeah, so he wasn't a star at the time, but unfortunately, he turns into Casey Affleck in the movie. They didn't really explain how that happened either. That was a hole in the plot. I don't know if he got cursed by a gypsy, or maybe he ate like a radiated moon rock or something. That science didn't really hold up. But aside from that,
yes,
lots of stars, lots of movie stars.
I absolutely prefer in a film where they cast a different age person for the different ages of the character instead of trying to do old age makeup.
I love old age makeup.
Drives me up the walls.
No, I agree.
The movie was nominated for 5 Academy Awards and won 4 Best Visual Effects, which are outstanding.
Miniatures. It has miniatures in it.
Yes. Yeah. It's so neat.
Although I think they called them like maxiatures because they were huge.
They're gigantic. Yeah. The premise of the movie was conceived by producer Linda Obst and theoretical physicist Kip Thorne, who collaborated on the film Contact. Strangely, the two met on a blind date set up by Carl Sagan.
Mm-hmm.
What? That's crazy.
Sagan had some intuition that that would be a good pairing, I guess.
Gosh, but yeah.
Kip Thorne, I believe, was a consultant throughout the production.
The movie was in development with Spielberg, and Jonathan Nolan was hired to write it, but due to some studio shifting stuff, Spielberg was off the project and Nolan stepped in. It's way more complicated than that, but that's all you need to know.
It's so complicated that actually the funding of this film involved a switching of rights for the Friday the 13th next film.
Yes. Uh-huh.
That's how complicated it was.
It's so complicated. Not important, though. Jonathan Nolan, to help write the script, he studied at the California Institute of Technology.
Yeah, studied the babes there. I think Nolan wrote a huge script. Jonathan Nolan, and then his brother had written a separate script that was about some similar things, but was actually a different story. And then they had the premise that was introduced by these producers, and they sort of mishmashed them all together.
Yeah.
And I felt a little of that patchwork development in the movie. I felt.
Yeah.
In some ways, I felt like this was almost like a movie musical, or like a jukebox musical, except with scientific concepts instead of hit songs.
I want to avoid spoilers for the first bit of the show, but we'll talk about the premise in case you don't know what it's about.
You're saying you're going to say generally what it was about.
Yeah,
and then
generally
and then
what it's about.
15 minutes, go watch it if you want to before we spoil
yes.
it. Okay.
Yeah. And in fact, I don't even want to talk about the end because I really like the movie and I think people should see it. The less you know but going into it, the more you might enjoy it because that was how it was for me. I'm going to dish it out a little bit at a time. The general premise of the movie is that Earth, sometime in the mid to late 21st century, is experiencing a climate crisis of some kind. We're not sure if it was because of a war or some other kind of problem, but there are no armies anymore. The government seemed to have kind of gone away. Nothing's explained. Farming is very important because there's a blight that is killing off most crops. Corn is the only thing that they're able to sustain. And I really enjoyed how they don't explain what happened with a bunch of exposition. You don't really need to know. It's not important. So they just kind of, you see these people living their lives, struggling, trying to make everything work, and how it's slightly different. It's very rural. You know, a lot of it takes place on a farm, but then there's all these little hints of technology.
I liked that, too. I watched the movie with Heather, and she was similarly blind to what happened in it. So initially, this was a surprise that it was this kind of post-apocalyptic setting. And, you know, we both, oh, it's this. That's all we needed to know, that this is what's mm-hmm. going on. But what I also didn't expect, there was a moment of horror for me when you learn at the school that they are kind of anti-science.
Yeah.
That they think the moon landing was faked and they're saying it was a ploy to bankrupt the Soviet Union. That's the history uh-huh. they've learned. I didn't know that. And that him being the character we're about to meet, Matthew McConaughey's character, is sort of a rebel in a way because he used to work for NASA.
Uh-huh.
And now they're saying that that was a totally faked enterprise. It really struck me in the gut when that happened.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and well, the character, too, he was pretty mad about it.
Yeah.
That he found out that his kid was learning that stuff in school.
Yeah.
Matthew McConaughey plays Joseph Coop Cooper, who is a widowed NASA pilot who became a farmer when NASA was shut down. He lives on the farm with his father-in-law, Donald, played by John Lithgow, another awesome actor just thrown in there, just peppered in,
mm-hmm.
and his teenage son, Tom, as you said, played by Timothy Chalamet,
yeah.
and his 10-year-old daughter, Murphy. The movie begins with interview footage of people recounting their experiences living through the Dust Bowl. And it seems to be the future of the movie, like beyond mm-hmm. all of the stuff that we're going to see. But the footage was actually taken from a Ken Burns documentary about people that actually lived through the dust storms in the 1930s.
The Dust Bowl, yeah. I thought that was a fantastic way to bring some verisimilitude to the whole thing.
Because I'm like, these people don't seem like actors. They're really good. They seem like real people.
Yeah.
Because they were.
Exactly. They weren't actors in old age makeup. A lot of scientists have weighed in on the movie, and to its credit, they really have to get kind of nitpicky about things they didn't like.
Uh-huh.
There are some ice clouds in the movie,
mm-hmm.
which was a highlight to me. Mm-hmm. They were frozen clouds that they were landing a spacecraft on. Sometimes scientists have said, no way. Gravity would pull those things down. They wouldn't be able to support a spaceship. The astrobiologist David Grinspoon criticized this blight situation on Earth that's portrayed in the early scenes.
Right.
Pointing out that even with a voracious blight, it would have taken millions of years to reduce the atmosphere's oxygen content. But, you know, I think the lack of explanation shoots that down. And when left ambiguous, my mind can find a way to figure it out.
Oh,
there's
sure.
something you don't know about that's causing this.
Yeah.
There's some oxygen vacuum or something, yeah. you know.
There's something, the blight consumes oxygen way more than any other life form does. Or, you know, it's
yeah.
it's exponentially, it's growing in a way that, you know, whatever. It, you know,
so
they don't
that
explain
didn't bother
it.
Me. No, yeah, yeah, they just didn't explain it. And I thought a Dust Bowl situation is especially terrible. The idea that the blight isn't just on the setting, but it gets inside your body.
Mm.
That you can't avoid the dust. The first image of the movie is the dust moving across a bookshelf. And there are also models of spaceships, both covered in dust to show that even in a high-tech world of exploration, time dominates it all. It's all lost in the sands of time, and the concerns of the human heart, even in the future, will still be primary. Exploration within will still be required.
Yeah,
And I feel like the movie more or less bore that out.
Yeah.
So, you know, here, listen. That's me patting myself on the back.
You deserve it.
Thank you.
Some weird gravitational stuff happens, as if there is an intelligence that is sending the Cooper family messages.
And that concerns the bookcase, volumes falling out of it, pattern forming on the floor. Some debate between the father and daughter about ghosts. He tells her to use the scientific method to investigate those supernatural beings. And I got that first act Hollywood feeling. He's teaching her something, but later she'll have to teach him something. He's ignoring something. Her belief sure. is just as valuable as his scientific method.
Sure.
And that's what he'll have to learn.
From these ghosts, they're given coordinates, which Coop and Murphy follow, and they lead them to a secret NASA base that's still doing work. NASA was supposedly shut down, but guess what? No, actually, they're doing stuff. Turns out that things are worse than anybody fears. The Earth is on the verge of an inevitable ecological collapse, and they plan, NASA, to find another habitable planet. This is possible because a wormhole opened up near Jupiter 48 years ago, and they've sent probes into it and found a bunch of potential habitable planets. I'll save the details for later, but they need Cooper to pilot the ship for them. The problem with this is that he'll have to leave his kids behind, and due to cryosleep and time dilation, he will age much slower than everybody else on Earth, and he doesn't actually know when he's going to be back because there's could be potential complications to what they're doing here. So he has to give up his family to save his family and everybody else on Earth, which is tough. Yeah, that's a hard thing to do. The movie, despite being very sci-fi, has a lot of emotional, character-driven story stuff and a lot about parenthood and responsibility, which resonated with me, of course.
Mm-hmm.
There's some pretty heavy quotes from the movie that just, I was like, whoa. One of them was, "Once you're a parent, you're the ghost of your children's future. We're just here to be memories for our kids."
Mm-hmm.
And I know that sounds a little like, oh, God, that's terrible. It's not terrible. It's like there's a natural order to things.
Yeah.
Where you have kids, you hand the baton to the next generation, and then they go on. And that's just the way things are supposed to be. And I think maybe a lot of the bad things in the world right now are due to people that don't understand that. They don't want to hand the baton off to the next generation. They want to keep hold of it, and they want more power and they want more control, when really that's not your job
mm-hmm.
as a parent. And I think most of these world leaders that are dubious have children. They're just really bad parents.
There's or a strange assumption that you want a strange selfishness in that you want your children to live some replica of what you experienced. I think there's a lot of like narcissism in that.
Yes.
That you can't accept that the world is going to change. Your job is to equip your kids to do well in that changed world, whether those are cultural or actual physical, technological changes in the world, instead of saying, no, the way I experience the world is the right way, and mm-hmm. you need to experience that too, which is a form of still selfishness and possessiveness.
Yeah.
McConaughey himself, a little bit of a character of himself, and I don't know if that's his fault or not, or if he even was at this point, but I had a hard time taking him seriously sometimes. Yeah. And even during this speech, it was funny because he gave that one award speech where he was like, I look up to me in 10 years. That's my hero. Me in 10 years.
What?
You know, you don't remember that? Yeah.
No.
He gave this whole
terrible
speech. When I was 25, you know who my hero was? Me at 35. And then when I was 35, you know who? Okay, we get
that
it.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, I didn't hate him for it, but I was like, when he was given this speech, that's immediately jumped into my mind, which is what can happen.
That's the exact opposite sentiment.
Well, right, I know, but I mean, it was the same as when Matt Damon showed up. I was like, it's evil Mark Watney from The Martian, you know. It's the problem with celebrities sometimes, and it was all celebrities in this movie.
Separating the actor from the character, it's tough at times. Yeah.
I was sitting there going, did they maybe overcompensate because there's hard science in it? Did they go, well, we better up the schmaltz value and the Hollywoodiness of it a little bit in order to keep people connected? But actually, I don't think they did that. I think it was fine.
I do, too. I thought it was great.
I realized about halfway through that my issue was that there's an assumption in the movie that humanity should be saved and that we should be allowed to leave the planet we've ruined.
Right.
I'm not even kidding. I think that was the tension that was going on with me.
Wow.
Is I was like, I don't know if I agree with the premise of this movie. Now, of course, they actually kind of talk about it. Mm-hmm. We're all selfish. So if it's to take care of my own children, you have a little bit more invested in it. You know, you're like, well, regardless of how I feel about the human race, I want things to be right for them. But yeah, I was kind of going, I don't know, everybody. Maybe you should just die with that planet. Does the universe really need you?
Yeah.
And I also loved the robots in the movie.
Yes.
And the worst way to criticize a movie is to say what I would have rather seen. So I'm not criticizing the movie for this, but in my head, I was like, I'd like a simpler version of this. And it's just the robots, no people in it.
Yeah, the robots. That was something that I thought about when I was doing notes for this, because the robots are really sophisticated. Mm-hmm. To the point of, did they really need to send people at all?
Well, right. I thought maybe they could be robots that were scanned personalities of people that used to be around. So they were kind of like RoboCop versions of a computer or something.
Yeah.
And they need to go on this very long mission because they're the only ones that can do it, not being human, in order to set up the plan A of this film to get everybody out to a different planet or whatever. And could they explore that question on their way? Like, hey, is what we're doing really worth it? You know,
that would be cool.
Is saving the gods worth it?
Should we save humans? Because they're not great.
They programmed us and we kind of know what their flaws are, but we also know what kind of world we could build. So now that we're halfway out and they can't recall us, should we do it or not? And if their personalities are from people that once existed, does that come into it as well? Because I always wondered, are computers, we say they become self-aware, but they were created by us. So you have Frankenstein issues with, like, what of our personality defects read onto them and stuff.
Uh-huh.
The movie dealt with that a little bit as well.
Yeah. Robots have personality and character and are very likable, even though they're blocks. They're basically huge blocks that are made into different sections, and those sections break into smaller sections.
Yeah, super neat. They were basically like giant flat R2-D2s.
Yeah,
because they
could
break into, their primary breakage was into three, so it was like the middle section being carried by two. But all of those sections could break into smaller sections as well, which made it really adaptable. Could turn into a big wheel if it needed to.
You did say the movie's a bit long, which it is. Mm. It's 169 minutes. So it's close to 3 hours. But like I said, I was so into it. And I was watching it with Finney. We both were.
Yeah.
The time flew for us.
I think I was craving some escape. And maybe that had to do with it. Again, your expectations going into it. I could have been transported a little more, I think. But that said, I didn't mind the running time either. Because even if I wasn't enjoying it, there was still something to think about. You know, I just enjoyed it in a different way.
Now, I want to go a little bit more specific. So let's give our listeners here an opportunity to step away. In the plot, when Coop shows up to NASA, he tells them that gravity gave him the coordinates to the secret facility. Mm-hmm. And they don't seem that surprised about it because they've also been getting gravity messages. The messages told them about the wormhole around Jupiter. They know that there's some kind of intelligence out there, but they don't know who they are or why they're helping Earth. They explain to Coop that they sent probes that discovered 12 potentially habitable planets on the other side of the wormhole. They're in stable orbit, but they're around a black hole, which... This wormhole leads to another galaxy, mm-hmm. which is really far away. The closest galaxy to ours is Andromeda, and that's 2.5 million light years away. So traveling at the speed of light, it would take 2.5 million years to get there. That's insane. But there is actually a dwarf galaxy that's closer, Canis Major, but it is being consumed by our own galaxy. So it doesn't really count.
You know, speaking of totally off topic, but I read mm-hmm. Remina by Junji Ito over the holidays, yeah. mm-hmm. which is about a planet becoming enamored of Earth and moving over here to see us. I recommend it if you want a crazy science fiction story. All right, back to Interstellar.
Yeah. Now, a wormhole is a hypothetical shortcut through space-time that connects two distant points, or two different times even, via mm-hmm. a tunnel-like geometry thing. And this is in general relativity. It can exist as a mathematical solution, but we don't know if nature actually allows a stable, usable wormhole to exist. Like, theoretically, it can happen, but right. we don't know if they actually do happen. And the versions that they come up with, they would collapse instantly unless it was held open by some kind of exotic matter with negative energy, which hasn't been shown to exist. It's all theoretical.
Some of this portal stuff reminded me of The Expanse.
Yes.
Which I love.
Here in this story, we've got a stable wormhole, and mm-hmm. it seems like this intelligence has the tech and the know-how to make this whole thing happen. NASA's plan A, which is, I thought all this stuff was so neat, is to find a habitable planet and also figure out how to counteract gravity so that they can get most of the people off of Earth and get them to this new planet, because that's going to be the problem. If you're going to, you know, rocket ships are really impractical way of getting people off the planet in mass. So if they mm-hmm. can figure out how to counteract gravity, then it'll be easy to get people off. In fact, they're building, the facility that they're working in is actually a spaceship stuck on Earth.
Yeah, it's their ark.
Yeah, it's their ark that they're building. But they haven't figured out how to get that dang thing off the planet. Michael Caine, Professor John Brann, is working on it. And he's like, close. We're going to figure it out. We're going to figure it out. But we've got all this time. We need to get moving right now. And we'll worry about that down the road.
I like this a lot, that part of the plan is figuring out part of the plan. It reminded me of last week's story where you need to be driven to ideate. You know, in that case, it was catching his wife in an affair. But here it's a ticking clock.
Right.
You know, all right, well, we just have to solve gravity. While you're going.
If that doesn't work, they've got plan B. Now, plan B, Coop's ship, the Endurance, has 5,000 frozen embryos to be used to populate the planet. Anne Hathaway, she's Dr. Amelia Brand, the daughter of Michael Caine's character. Mm-hmm. She could conceivably have a kid, and then that kid could have another, and they could keep, she can have a bunch of kids, and then those kids could all mate with each other because they're actually genetically totally different because they're from different embryos.
Right.
And then repopulate the planet. But this would mean that Coop's crew, which is a small crew, it's only four people. It's Dr. Amelia Brann, Anne Hathaway, Doyle, a NASA astronaut, and Professor Momoli, a NASA scientist who would be responsible for saving and rebuilding the human race. Those four people. But mm-hmm. I also thought, like, well, what about animals and plant life? Is that
That's
also
why Dr.
Be?
Jonathan Chase is there.
The fifth member
yes.
of the crew. But also the
he
robot.
He has all of the animals within him.
Yes, that's true. That makes sense. But then there's also the robot. It's called TARS, T-A-R-S.
It threw me off that the voices of the robots were so human a little bit, though, too, because sometimes when the ensemble was speaking, I didn't know it was a robot doing the speaking.
Yeah.
It's, I wanted them to talk like this, so I knew it was a robot. Like, you don't have a robot accent.
So before the mission, they sent out 12 astronauts to survey the 12 planets. Their job was to see which of these 12 planets would be the best place to make a new Earth. Mm-hmm. And what they would do is they would go there, put themselves in cryosleep, and then wait to be woken up. Dr. Mann, played by Matt Damon, was the astronaut who was in charge of all of this. Most of them knew that it was going to be a one-way mission, that the likelihood of them actually being picked up was probably pretty low.
Yeah.
So their job was going to be get to the planet, check it out, send up information, and then wait. And hopefully you'll be rescued. Maybe you won't be. Cool. I love it. I'm super into this whole idea. Coop ship is supposed to have enough fuel to return, but they do have this issue with time dilation. Being mm-hmm. so close to the black hole will cause them to age slower, so time on Earth will pass quickly, which is a ticking clock, before everybody on Earth dies. So they've really got to be careful about how they do things, because if they go on a mission to one of these planets, which happens, 7 years goes by on Earth for an hour to them, which is crazy.
Yeah, it's very intelligent construction of the story that it matters, because obviously you don't want to come back and your kids are old, or older than you.
Yeah, or the human race is dead.
This is a very simple movie in that it's saying, given the choice, to separate from your own children, would you take it in order to save all of the children?
But they made it interesting, too, because they said, well, you have a pilot already for this. Matthew McConaughey, Coop says this. Mm-hmm. And they're like, yeah, but he's not as good as you. So you would be better suited for this, and you would probably be the best man for the job. He could conceivably go, it's not my problem. I'm going to stay here and raise my kids.
And that's true. It's a choice. But he has also had some divine intervention. He feels chosen by the message they've received.
Yes.
And they don't understand who it's from yet. And spoiler, it turns out to be from them. They've somehow tried to help themselves from.
Yes. Because part of this, the gravity problem that they're trying to deal with is that they need to be able to get data from inside the horizon of a black hole, which you can't escape. So there's no way to get this information. That's the big problem. And then you find out that Michael Caine's character was totally BSing. Their plan A was never going to work. He knew it would never.
Right.
Couldn't figure out gravity because they don't have that information. They can't get that information.
Because Jessica Chastain figures out, well, wait a minute. You guys are accepting time as a constant and it's not. And we just don't know what it is. And that's some of the information that's going to be sent back, et cetera.
And Murph, Jessica Chastain is Coop's daughter grown up. In fact, she gets to be older. There's a point where she sends him a message that says, I'm the same age now you were when you left.
Yeah.
And, you know, for him, it's like a week has gone by. So it's totally crazy. There's just a lot of really cool stuff. I don't want to talk too much more about it, except they go to a few planets. That's amazing. Like, the planets are so neat, even though there really isn't much to them.
Yeah.
But it feels really alien and it feels really desperate.
Yeah, I thought Matt Damon's character was great, too, even though, you know, you sort of see it coming that he's a villain.
Yes.
But it's fun when he shows up, and I love the way he expresses himself when he's doing dastardly things. He's just a good villain. This would be a good companion piece with The Martian. And I have to say that I loved Anne Hathaway's character's speech about love as an indicator, because they have a choice at one point between going to two different planets, and she's in love with the person who is on the one planet. So obviously she's got a reason.
Uh-huh.
But she sort of says, well, how do we know that that's not an indicator past, you know, is there something more to it? Is love a kind of scientific way? I don't know how the data is being correlated, but this is a gift. This is telling me to go do this.
Yeah.
Like, should we listen to intuition? Or things on the level of intuition. And I don't know. I actually, reading about this morning, it seems that some people didn't like that. I found it corny. But actually, I loved that part of it. Because I think on a day-to-day basis, I make decisions based on intuition. And I go ahead and trust that. Because my body does all sorts of things I don't think about, obviously. You know, it decides what rate to breathe at, where to send blood. Mm-hmm. All sorts of things it doesn't need to check in with my decision-making process about. So if I'm at the grocery store and there's two exact same versions of the product and some intuition says take the left one and not the right one, I go ahead and do that.
You have to.
Yeah.
At some point, there's just not enough time to belabor every decision that you're going to make. You just have to trust your gut. And, you know, it'll be wrong sometimes.
Right.
And that's something that is said, too, in that discussion that they're having, where he says, we make mistakes all the time, and you might be making a mistake right now. It's not the right intuition that you're trying to trust. And they go against her intuition in that story.
Yeah.
Which actually didn't really work out for the best.
It didn't work out very well, no.
But ultimately, maybe it did. Because it does have kind of an up ending. It does end in a way that's very positive, and I needed that. I just want people to know that, too. I don't want to spoil it too much, but it ended in a way that felt good and hopeful.
I think we're some of the last people to see this movie, so it's funny to be, it's funny to be protecting people from revelations about it. They're yeah, man.
I'm sure, yeah. I just, because we were talking about all this stuff in The Man Who Killed Muhammad and time travel, because there is some talk of time travel in here and some information is being sent through time, which is theoretically, again, possible. There's a bit of a bootstrap paradox that happens with these things, where the whole reason he went was to be in the future to send back the messages. So everything that happened would have had to happen for him to do what he did. If that makes sense.
Which is always hard to wrap your mind around.
Yeah. Where did the idea come from? And this is something we've talked about. It's the one that I love, which I think we've talked about before, is a guy goes back in time, accidentally kills Bach. And but he's an expert in Bach. He knows everything about Bach. And so he takes over Bach's life and writes all of Bach's music.
I'll Be Back is the name of that
movie. I'll Be Back. That's the name of that movie, yeah. You know, it works. And then he dies. You know, he gets old and he's like, oh, wait, I'm actually living Bach's life. So wait a minute. Who actually wrote that music? Because I heard it. Mm-hmm. And I learned it from this other source. I learned it from myself.
Yeah.
So where did it come from? And that's the bootstrap paradox.
Where does he ever find out?
No.
It's not Dr. Jonathan Chase? Perhaps.
You know, we still have one more Manimal.
You talking about that Nightman?
I'm talking about Nightman. So that still exists. Where I'm holding out on that one because I've never seen it. And it is the last Manimal in existence.
Oh, yeah, I know. We do need to cover that.
But then again, also, I don't want it to be over because I still have that to look forward to, that Nightman episode. Nightman.
Oh, boy. You know, yeah, I have that bookmarked on YouTube. Uh-huh. All right, we're going to have to cover that.
We'll think about it. I want to thank Finian and his buddy Issa for suggesting this film. Because good job, guys.
That's what it took for me to watch it. Thank you, guys. Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, and it was fun, and it's fun to talk about it. And I want to thank you, our patrons, for giving us the ability to be able to talk about these things to you.
That's all we have for this Extra Credit episode. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.